Yes, it's Pet Chat, and it's the first Wednesday of the month, and I'm joined by Dr. David Tabbert. No Cheryl today?
No, I'm solo.
Solo.
Well, you're steering the ship.
I am. I try to.
Thanks, Amanda.
Sometimes it's a bit hairy.
We'll stay away from the icebergs.
We will. Yeah, it's not the Titanic today, please.
Absolutely. No, very pleased to be here, but this is going to be my last show for the year.
Oh.
Out of the trio of our vet team. So over the next 2 weeks before the lifestyle programs wrap up.
Yes, well, we better make sure it's a fun show.
Let's make it a good one.
Yes, and we get lots of callers.
Absolutely.
And now what are you going to talk about today?
Well, I had some notes here from last time, but one thing that I've noticed in our hospital just over the last week, we are seeing so many cats that have got urinary blockage.
Right.
Yes, it's quite remarkable. I went in the hospital this morning and there's five patients in hospital, one dog and four cats, and three of the cats are in there with blocked bladders.
Urinary blockages for cats. And
yes.
Why and how and what's going on?
Well, I led into this saying that, you know, we had this number of cats in our hospital, and it looks unusual to have three out of four cats in the hospital with that. But I think if you average it out, I'm not sure that there's like a, you know.
An epidemic?
Yes. No, there's nothing like that. Just certainly the more complicated ones that end up in hospital a bit longer, et cetera, are going to be there. So, but let's just get back to the definition, because we kind of said blocked cats. What are we talking about? So we're talking about an obstruction in the urinary outflow.
Okay.
So generally it's from the bladder and urethra, can occur in male and female, more common in males, associated with anatomy. They have a narrower urethra and longer, so that it's more likely to get a blockage. And we do see it in cats and dogs, but for different reasons. So in cats, we see it more commonly associated with a couple of things. One is that their kidneys actually concentrate their urine much more, which means if there's any excess mineral in their bloodstream that gets filtered out in the kidneys, then it's going to concentrate, which means the molecules of the minerals, there's less water between the molecules, so then they come together and they'll clump.
Right.
And so hence, you know, you get to that position because cats are a desert creature. So their kidneys have a massive ability to concentrate and preserve water, but that counts against them in some circumstances. And, you know, the things that can happen there is when they can get an infection, or there's stress in their lifestyle, or some dietary factors that can also increase that amount of mineral, as I was talking about, then those things can actually increase the likelihood of a urinary outflow obstruction. Also, in cats, male cats that are desexed, we do see more commonly, but the general thinking is that that's because they're a bit more overweight.
Right. So too many biscuits.
There's a bit too much pudding. And so, you know, there's a couple of things that does. One is it increases the fat deposits inside the pelvis, which makes it harder for them to empty the bladder, which means they retain urine, which gives minerals time to come together rather than flushing them through. They don't exercise as much, so, you know, they're not emptying their bladder as much.
Is it painful? Is it like, you know, when humans get a urinary tract infection,
I'd
assume it would be painful.
Incredibly painful. But the real problem comes that when they actually get to the point where they've got a complete outflow blockage and they can't get rid of the urine, because, look, urine is not meant to be retained in the body for a huge amount of time. And so toxins can start to leach out of the urine into the bladder wall and into the tissue, into the bloodstream. And it also produces back pressure onto the kidneys and shuts down the kidneys. So we get a buildup of potassium in the blood, because the kidneys can't get rid of it. And that's the main way that the body gets rid of potassium. And you might think, oh, well, what does that mean? Well, a lot of our salts in our body maintain water balance, maintain the acid levels, et cetera. And so it also influences things like heart function, nerve function, muscle function, all of those things. So if you get an increase in potassium, it can be fatal. And this is the real risk associated with block cats, is that if we don't get the urine flowing, yes, they can get kidney failure or injury from the back pressure, but the real urgency is associated with their potassium levels that can build up rapidly, and that can actually stop the heart.
Wow.
So that's when it becomes that real emergency situation. Now, just backtracking a little bit, and that is, how would you recognize it if your cat or dog, as I said, you know, does experience a urinary outflow obstruction? And that is, well, certainly they're less frequently going to the toilet. And when they do, it seems to either they're taking a very long time, the urine flow is very slow, it might be pigmented, like red as in blood. And, you know, in a lot of cases with cats, if they're using a litter tray, then you'll see they'll go to the litter tray and they look like they're going to go to the toilet, but nothing happens. Or maybe only a drop or two comes out. And often people say, and, you know, it looked like blood came out, which is blood-stained urine. So this signals, as I said, an emergency situation, because often when those cats come in, their bladders are actually quite large. And there have been cases, even in kind of really severe, where we see bladder rupture. It's remarkable how large and tense that bladder can get, which comes back to your question, Amanda, about pain. It is a very painful condition. So if you're at home and you've got cats and you know, may be familiar with these symptoms, but really it's looking at the going to the litter tray, they're not able to pass anything, or they're going frequently and they're just passing a small amount. And obviously if you see blood in the litter tray, that sort of thing, or reddish, even pinkish urine, then I would be saying that is another situation we need to treat them pretty quickly and urgently. So that kind of gets us in to where you're actually taking your animal to the vet. We could probably jump into one, you know, the thing I like to focus on is how do you prevent this happening, so that for all those people who've been through this, because unfortunately with cats, if they have an episode like this and then treated, it does have a high rate of recurrence. So we want to try and prevent it, and it'd be good to prevent it in the first place. So first of all, if for litter trays is the number one thing. So my rule is very simple. It's one litter tray per cat plus one. So if you've got one cat, two trays, two cat, three trays, five cats, six trays.
Wow.
Around the house.
And you get a smelly house.
Well, good point is you need to use a good quality litter. Sometimes it's a good idea to have different types of litter. So if you've only got the one cat, have two different types of litter. Find the one that they like the best. Because obviously if you have four cats, you're probably going to find that one cat prefers one litter, one cat prefers another. It's pretty annoying, but it's to help them be healthy. And the reason we do that is that we want to encourage them to use the litter tray, which also, picking up on what you said, we also want to make sure we clean it regularly because that can put them off going back to the litter tray. Cats can be pretty fussy.
Yes, I've got one.
Pretty fussy. And so you want to, like, make it easy for them. And, you know, you can even get the self-cleaning litter trays that'll actually – they've got a motorized scoop that goes over the top of them. And that, you know, cuts down on the work that you might have to do. But very simply, we just want to make sure we remove any waste that they've put into the litter tray and restock it so that they've got a fresh litter tray as often as possible. Otherwise, if they look at the litter tray and go, nah, I'll go later, what that means is the urine's retained in the bladder just that little bit longer. Like I said, the urine's concentrated, which means there's not enough water in there. And so then the minerals start to come together and cause problems.
Okay. All right. Well, it's interesting, actually. All right, well, we might continue this a bit later. We've got Stuart from Rutherford on the line. Hi, Stuart. Thanks for holding.
That's okay. How are you today?
Good, thank you. You've got a question for us.
Yes. I've seen cats and dogs eat grass. Why is that? Does that help with the by their stomach acid?
It's a good question, and I'd be keen to hear from any vets who have a good answer for this one, because sometimes, you know, people say, particularly with dogs, but you're right, I've seen cats do it as well. Oh, yes. If the dog eats grass, you know, it means they're going to be sick or they are sick. And grass can sometimes act as a purgative, which induces or causes them to, or assists them to vomit.
It's only a certain type of grass, but isn't it?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say I've really identified that, but I have seen dogs eat the same grass that'll make them vomit, go back and eat the grass and they don't vomit.
That's right, yeah.
So, my dogs are quite happy to eat grass from time to time, depending on where we walk them, and for no reason. Like, they're not vomiting, they're not sick or anything. It's just something they want to do. There is also the theory, or the certainly makes sense, is to say, well, it's going to increase the fibre in their gut. And, you know, I think that's reasonable. The dogs, I don't think they consciously know that, but...
They just automatically do it I see them do it. They just walk along and all of a sudden they just start eating grass.
Yes. I think the other thing that happens is, and this probably is true with cats maybe more than dogs, but again, is it's just another way to interact with their environment. And, you know, we've got all our senses, our taste, touch, sight, hearing. The taste is one that they might be engaging with.
Yeah, it tastes strange because I've eaten it.
Now, I just should be careful that because...
Actually, it tastes nice.
Well, it's good.
The juices in it taste different.
Yeah. I'm not sure that we're set up quite the same way. But if we were looking at, dogs as a species, they are, you know, somewhat similar to us in our digestive. It's not like we're cows, which require to eat grass to get the breakdown of cellulose, etc. But yes, they're not doing it for energy reasons. Maybe they're doing it for fibre. Maybe it's a behavioural thing to interact with the environment. I mean, we do see any kind of obsessive eating behaviour would be fit into the realm of a behavioural problem, where it's an obsessive behaviour anyway. It just directed against, you know, to grass. But it's not I don't think there's a really definitive answer to that question.
No, well, thank you very much for that.
No worries.
Interesting question anyway. And thank you. Your caller number 46.
Oh, what's on?
Awesome. All right, we need a 47
Stuart.
Now. Thanks so much, Stuart.
Yeah, that was great.
See you, mate.
Have a Merry Christmas, everyone.
Yeah, you too.
Bye.
Okay, rock on.
Bye. To NURFM 103.7, this is Pet Chat with Dr. David Tabrett, and we've got Evie from Raymond Terrace on the line. Evie, you are caller number 47, and we just want to know, you've got a good question. What causes a cat to get fluid in its lungs?
Yes.
Hi, Evie. What's going on?
I actually don't have my cat anymore, sadly. I did have to put her down a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
Due to the fluid in her lungs. And then she was she just deteriorated so quickly. So I'm just wondering what would have caused her to get that so much fluid in her lungs that it was actually the vets couldn't do anything to help her.
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that news. It's anytime I see that kind of phrasing, fluid in their lungs, it's very troubling. So I guess did we want to talk about your cat or cats generally?
Just cats generally.
With fluid in their lungs and how it can be there. Okay.
How does it get in there?
Yes.
But so quick.
Yes.
My cat was fine, and then, I noticed that she wasn't herself for a few days, but I didn't think anything of it because she was, you know, I just thought that was her nature.
Yes.
But then she just deteriorated rapidly that day, and then, she just couldn't breathe properly.
Yeah, obviously. And how old was she?
She was 5.
Oh, okay. All right. So... when we say fluid, I guess it's important just to clarify, and this is for your cat, but for any other examples, fluid can be a number of different things. So when, as vets, we say fluid in its lungs, we're usually referring to either what we call a transudate or an exudate. And what that means is it's a plasma-type fluid that has a varying degree of protein and cells in it, okay? And an exudate will have more protein and more cells in the fluid. And yep. When I say cells, I mean white blood cells, okay? So yep. Now I'm giving you a clue, blood. It's coming from the yep. blood. So the other types of fluid, though, that we can get, and just so we can move past this little point, is fluid could be blood, and it could also occur associated with, like it could be bleeding, that's what I'm saying, or it could be tumours. So we can get fluid for a number of different reasons. But when generally, if we know that it's a bleeding problem, then most of the time we'll say they've got blood in their lungs or tumours, then we kind of clarify it pretty straight away that it is tumours. But both of those things can cause fluid in the lungs. The other thing is that when we say in their lungs, the lungs contain airways, but also there's a space around the lungs, and that's called the pleural space. And sometimes we'll see cats and dogs, for that matter, that can get fluid in that pleural space around the lung. And what that can do is it actually compresses the lung and it makes it hard for them to breathe. And again, it could be bleeding, it could be tumours, it could be a transudate or an exudate. Yeah. So coming back to the fluid in the lungs, which is generally in the airways, most of the time we're talking the very, very small airways or the alveoli or the bronchi, which are, if you think of the lungs, are like a big tree going all the way out to the leaves. Well, that's, you know, that would be where your alveoli are, which are these little kind of tiny bubbles where there's a blood vessel right next to an air sac. And there's only a very thin layer between those two things, and it's designed so that oxygen can come in and carbon dioxide can go out. But if something happens to disrupt either the pressure in the vessel or disrupts the wall in the airway. So pressure in the vessel, what could disrupt that? The most common thing we see is heart disease, yeah. Where we get problems with blood flow in and out of the heart, and that can actually lead to a buildup of pressure in the lungs, and the fluid basically has nowhere to go, so it leaks through the wall and into the air sac and floods the air sac. And in terms of the rapid deterioration, you know, there's people walking around with they've had a lung removal, okay, so you can yeah. survive on one lung, but you can't really do a lot. And if you lose any more lung function after that, you're going to be in real trouble. So it really depends on how much of the lung is involved. And that's why you can kind of go from being, oh, they're a little bit off, to, oh, my gosh, they're like dying in front of our eyes, because it doesn't yeah. take that much more fluid to tip them over the edge. So
yeah.
it could be heart disease. We can also see things like pneumonia and infections that can also cause a buildup of fluid, and that's more of an exudate inside the actual air sac. The other thing we can see is toxins. So I mentioned bleeding. You could have rat bait toxins which cause bleeding, but also there's a couple of other toxins around farmland and things like that that can actually cause trouble with the fluid in the lungs. There are some toxic plants that'll do the same thing. But the most common cause is heart disease, and it can progress really rapidly. And it's hard to say, like in a five-year-old cat, because it could be any of those things. So it's a bit hard to say. I'm really sorry to hear that. And such a young age. So, yeah, it's not.
I also was wondering, a few months ago she did have, like, she fell off the lounge.
Mm-hmm.
And then she would not, like, she was wobbly on her feet. So would have that been, like, the start of that rapid declining, like, if you know what I mean?
It could be, but I'd be thinking what caused her to fall off the lounge. Because cats are pretty agile, right?
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering about if there was some other thing that caused her to lose a balance or lose an awareness of where she is, in which case, you know, was there some sort of brain problem as well? Don't know. But or heart disease could cause it, because it could cause weakness. So you can kind of see you got this puzzle of where these pieces come together, or it could be completely unrelated. But it certainly it could have been an interaction that there was a connection there. Obviously, it's a bit hard to answer with in hindsight, but I could see ways that those two things could connect. So it's just a difficult time for you, and I understand it, how hard that can be. So I appreciate you ringing in, asking those questions.
Thank you so much.
No worries. Thanks, Evie.
Evie. Appreciate your call.
Bye.
Okay, next we've got Michelle from Windermere Park. Michelle, you've got a problem with your neighbour's cat going to the toilet in your yard.
Yes, hi.
Hi, Michelle. Good.
Listen, it's not a problem with one cat. It's a problem with about six cats. Now, I live on a property that has a house up the front and a house down the back. And the problem being is, one, my plants with these cats out at night, and also my poor neighbour, she got her cat. She only got one cat. She got mange, and so they locked the cat inside. I've spoken to the person. Now, look, there's about six cats.
Mm.
Now, my problem is, how do I keep them away from my place?
Yep.
I've had many comments, which you could imagine what the comments are. I've got a spray bottle with water in it.
Yep.
My plants have been killed. And besides that, they run amok at night.
Okay. Before David answers that, can I just get you to turn your radio off, Michelle?
Can you go and turn the radio?
Yeah, it's just echoing. Thanks.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
No problems.
Michelle, do you have a dog?
No.
No. Well, that solves your problem. I'm not going to suggest that you just go out and get a dog to fix this problem, but the cats. So when cats, and this is obviously the scenario when you're in, you know, property, you've got a lot more space around you, but the same applies for suburbia. As far as cats are concerned, I live at this house and next door and that door and the house behind and the house in front. Like, they're... idea of territory is, a fairly broad area. There's kind of this idea that they like to live in a 200-metre zone, but they'll travel a couple of kilometres outside that and have interactions, but they'll also consider anything within their 200 metres is basically theirs. So unless there's a reason for them not to go into your area, your yard, or something to deter them from that, then they're basically, that's just their natural behaviour. And
I can understand that but I was under the assumption that you could only have one or two cats that have to be locked up at night. Is that true?
It depends on... because you're studying, this is kind of getting into the legal / rules, council rules. So off the top of my head, I don't know that that's actually like a state law, but then I should know. But as far as number of animals go, like, you can have two, I don't know about six. But again, the rules may be different where you've got some acreage or some space. And it really also depends on the local council and how they would apply those laws and regulations. Yeah. This was when you called up originally and Amanda was writing up the notes, I was thinking this will end up being a scenario where the best idea Because you said, you know, you've already tried a few things. You got the spray bottle, etc.
And canine pepper and citrus fruit. Yeah.
Like, and all of those things may help somewhat or are totally useless. I wouldn't say don't do any of those things, like, because obviously it could be deterring at least some activity. But I think it's a good idea to get clarity from counsel. And it's a very, very grey area, but it's also really controversial because, again, going back to the native natural behaviour of cats, I think the bigger problem is also not just what they're doing in your yard, and cats at night need to be kept inside because they are, as we know, killing wildlife all over the place. And so even whether they're on a farm or not, they're still going to be doing that sort of behaviour. And
we're sick of picking up.
Cleaning up.
That's birds in the morning.
Probably worth calling the council.
I would have a chat to council and just be in the context of saying, here's the scenario, what can I do? And without necessarily saying you have to fix it, because I'm going to tell you it won't really go very far, but at the same time you can get some more information about what your rights are around this. And ultimately, education is always the most helpful thing, particularly when it comes to our native animals. We want to look after them as well. So hopefully that kind of triggers a bit of a consideration of conscience.
Yeah.
And the cats get kept in at night.
Fingers crossed. Thank you for your call, Michelle. Good luck with that. This is Pet Chat on 2 and URFM. We almost made it. This is caller number 49. Hi, from Karooa. Tracy, how are you going?
Good, thanks, yourself.
Good, thank you. You've got an issue with your cavoodle?
Yes, yes. I worry about it because, you know, like, we've had some hot days, as you know, and she just goes, like, go out to the toilet and that, and then she'll just lie in the sun on the grass, and I call her and she just doesn't want to move. That's not normal, is it?
How old is she?
Oh, she'll be 3 next week.
It's normal. She moving around okay though? No problems with mobility generally, hopping up and down on the lounge if you let her on the lounge?
She flies off the lounge.
She flies around.
Yeah.
Yeah. Look, my dogs do the same thing. And I think, what are you doing out in the sun? But now, what colour coat does she have?
Black.
Okay, well, that's a bit of a problem.
Is it?
Yeah, because she'll heat up really quickly. The black absorbs the sunlight. So I think what happens is they're feeling, you know, I want a bit of warmth, go and lay in the sun, and then they fall asleep.
And they
kind of forget to get up and come in. They can. The reason I asked about mobility is I've seen problems with dogs that have had severe arthritis. They can't get up. And then they're in the sun, and you're absolutely right. When it starts to get hot, look out this weekend, by the way.
Yeah.
Pretty warm. Yeah. And we see dogs come into our hospital with heat stroke and heat stress because they have severe arthritis and can't get up out of the sun. And a black dog is always going to be affected more severely than a lighter colour. So it's a normal thing, but I think just making sure there's plenty of differing areas with sunlight and shade, and then you know the little trampoline beds that they can hop on?
Yep. She's got one.
Yeah.
She doesn't really like it. She just prefers, like, I've got a, you know, cooling mat, and, like, she's an inside dog.
Yes.
And so she's got all that. But I also bought her some sunscreen, some zinc and everything.
For which part of her? For her nose?
Yeah.
She got a pink nose?
Well, that the zinc is pink, but no, her nose is black.
Oh, okay. It probably won't be a big problem. It's I say that now, and then in 10 years you'll ring me up and say, now she's got cancer on her nose. It's unusual. The problems we see with dogs with squamous cell carcinomas or skin cancers is usually in pink-nosed dogs, and we see lots of bull terriers that like to lie on their back with pink bellies, and then they get these cancers on their skin. So And same with cats too. Cats on their ears and on their nose where they're pink. Usually if they're pigmented, yeah, they seem to be okay. It is possible, of course, to get, you know, melanomas and so on in those areas. But, look, it's fine. If you, the zinc goes on, just don't be too heavy with it. And if she's licking it off all the time, then I wouldn't be putting it too much more on.
Okay. So, I also bought the some thing stuff to go on her paws, like for that keeps her, that doesn't burn her, you know, because when we go to the, you know, down, we've got a pool and she goes in the pool in a boat and the pavers down there are really hot. So I've bought some stuff so that to protect her paws.
What, little booties?
No, no, it's cream that it, it's called paw balm.
Oh, it probably doesn't prevent anything. But if they get sore feet, it'd work afterwards.
Oh, okay.
So I think you'll be fine. But it's yeah.
Thank you.
That won't be a problem. But yeah, just bring her in if you can out of the sun and make sure she's got plenty of fresh water around. Multiple sources.
Thanks, yep. Tracy. Thanks for your call.
Thanks, Tracy.
Okay. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Well, we've had a very busy day. You made it to 49 calls. Unfortunately, didn't make it to the 50th.
Look, I'm like the Bradman. I fell short right
did.
At the...
You did. And hopefully there's a goal for next year. There you go. So.
I'm going to get chided for my arrogance about equating my phone call experience with Donald Bradman, the great Sir Don Bradman.
Oh. There you go.
All right.
We are out of time and we'll do Pets of the Week next week.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye. Have a nice Christmas.
Yeah.